funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you define a bargain, and what criteria do you use to distinguish between a purchase that truly adds value to your life and one that is simply inexpensive? In the current economy, discount racks seem to outnumber those stocked with full-price merchandise, which can lead us consumers to assume we are getting the deals of a lifetime. My guest today is no stranger to the thrill of the hunt, but after looking closely at the tricks marketers have used to keep us buying what we don't really need or even want, she's concluded that our obsessive pursuit of ever less expensive products has left us with a lot more stuff and a lot less value than is good for us. Ellen Ruppelschell is a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. Her newest book is called Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Ellen, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Reading this book, it really does seem that we need to redefine what a bargain actually is. What is the difference for you between a good deal and a real value?
You know, I think most of us know this, and maybe many of us have forgotten it. I know that I had before I began research on this book. I think, like our parents and grandparents told us, a good value is not always the very, very cheapest thing. We used to be a lot more careful about looking at goods and doing a little balancing act between the price and the value of the object. And what I show, I hope, what I argue in the book is that for all sorts of reasons, we've come to discount the idea of quality in goods and sometimes even think less about why we're buying something than we once did. Which can fool us into making some very poor decisions for ourselves, and ultimately, which has, you know, fairly serious ramifications for us as a society.
Well, and obviously there's a lot of waste taking place here, and you tell a great little anecdote in the book that I think we can all relate to about having to buy a pair of boots for an event that you were going to. Can you recall that for us?
Sure. Yeah, a lot of people have asked me about that. I think your listeners could really relate to this because I'm sure they're big boot buyers. I live in New England where we have to wear boots in the winter, and I was looking for a pair of boots to go with an outfit I had bought on sale for a New Year's Eve party, and went to my local store and tried on a number of boots and didn't buy the comfortable boots that were, you know, fashionable and comfortable and really fit well because I thought they were too expensive. Instead, bought a much cheaper pair of boots that weren't so comfortable, but I thought, well, okay, they're good enough. I wore them one evening to that New Year's Eve party and threw them to the back of my closet with what I call my pile of shame, things that I bought at discount, wore once or twice, and then was very, very unhappy with. And in fact, this particular event was one of a number of events that led me to start thinking about why I was doing this, because I think of myself as a pretty rational person, and yet I was doing something that I knew in the long run, and even in the short run, was not satisfying me as a consumer and was, in fact, costing me a good deal of money.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Ellen, because, you know, we can buy one pair of boots for a certain price or three or four cheaper pairs for the same amount of money that might last us all together the same amount of time. But there's also the environmental cost here that doesn't get factored in.
Absolutely. And in fact, you make a good point. You know, even if these boots are longer, you know, lasting, not all cheap things are not durable things, but oftentimes they're not actually what we really wanted in the first place. And when that happens, it's almost like eating junk food that you're not really satisfied with until you tend to overeat it. When you make purchases of things that you're not really happy with, you tend to overbuy. And that's what deep discount shopping is often about, is the idea of attracting your attention, buying things based on price rather than on real value, and then coming home with a whole lot of stuff that you may not want. The environmental impact of this, of course, is quite dramatic in all sorts of spheres, whether it be food or electronics or wood products. You know, we are using a lot more materials than we might otherwise use if we were a little bit more value-driven rather than low-price-driven.
Yeah, it's what some people call the Snackwells effect. You can eat one really good piece of chocolate or a whole sleeve of low-fat cookies that taste like cardboard.
Exactly. Exactly right.
You know, there are people who argue that if you're talking about a consumer good, whether it's a piece of clothing or those boots, that at least if we're buying these things from a foreign country and they're cheap, we're creating work opportunities in the developing world. You, though, having looked at how those economies operate, are not convinced that we're doing those workers any favor.
Well, you know, of course we're creating work opportunities in the developing world. But what I argue is this. We're not providing necessarily good jobs for people in the developing world, and those are jobs that are going to leave those countries soon after another country comes up with an even lower price model. So what I argue is what we're doing here is chasing after countries where the rule of law is not so strong. When there's environmental regulations in place, when there are human rights regulations in place, when workers have some semblance of rights, the price goes up, okay? The price of production goes up. And so oftentimes we'll pull out. So even though, you know, we were in Mexico, we still are in Mexico in certain industries, we pulled out of Mexico in some industries, like in the textile industry, when the price went up, and we went to China. And then we were in China for a while, and of course we're still very, you know, China is still the factory to the world. But in some cases, factories pulled out of China and went to Vietnam or Indonesia or wherever the price was the lowest. There was even some talk about moving to Africa. I call this kind of a fool's errand. You know, we're chasing the price lower and lower. And I also argue this has come back to haunt us in terms of stagnant wages and benefits for most Americans, for 90% of Americans. Their income has been flat or going down for the last decade. So we are affected by the so-called China price or the lowering of wages. And globally, I don't think it's a good long-term scheme for the global economy. I also argue that the recession that we've been experiencing since December of 2008, December of 2007, if I've got it correctly, the last 20 months, can be linked to some degree with this pursuit of lower and lower price.
Another remarkable thing that you have in the book is an examination of the fact that we could, in fact, afford to spend 30% more on labor in some developing countries, and I think you cited Mexico, and it would literally cost like less than a quarter on a $20 shirt that we were to purchase. We could afford, I think, even those of us on a tight budget, to pay more. Why is it that manufacturers keep slashing wages when it really wouldn't affect the cost of their product to pay their workers what in any particular area is a much more livable wage?
Well, yes, you're right. I was quoting there an economist at the University of Massachusetts who did a calculation on shirt manufacturer and found that we could increase substantially the wages of people making those shirts in Mexico, and it would result in the increase of a cost to us of less than 2%. So it would be about 24 cents on a $20 shirt. Now, surveys of Americans indicate that we are more than willing to pay a little bit more, not a lot more, not you know, dollars and dollars more, but a little bit more to be assured that the products that we have are made under safe conditions and environmentally correct conditions. But manufacturers are not giving us that choice. Retailers are not giving us that choice. They're not telling us how these things are made. Sometimes it's even difficult to find where things are made, right? They're not giving us lists of their suppliers. So we really don't know, and it certainly profits the shareholders and the executives of these companies to keep their prices as low as possible, to make their profits as high as possible. They're not necessarily passing the cost of the low prices down to us. They're passing part of that low price, but oftentimes I found surprisingly that discounters' prices are not even as low as we think they are. So it's a very complicated story, but it's, as you said, I think it's a very fascinating one, and it certainly opened my eyes to what we should think about in terms of value.
I want to talk for a minute about Walmart. There is no shortage of criticism for some of the ways that Walmart does business and some of its business practices. And there are plenty of people who choose deliberately not to shop there. But the truth is, you found that Walmart's policies affect even those of us who never spend a dime there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people, very, you know, good and thoughtful people shop at Walmart because they really feel it's a virtuous thing to do, to provide for their family the best possible way they can. And they think, you know, if I go to Walmart, I will save money, I'll be able to, you know, put more money aside for my kids' education. I mean, they're very good reasons to choose to shop at Walmart. Unfortunately, lots of times we don't think about what the, you know, the damage, the collateral damage of a major discount retailer can do to a community. So, yes, it does lower the cost of a shopping basket, some shopping baskets, when you go to Walmart. Now, I do point out that about one-third of goods at Walmart, on average, are priced at the same or higher prices than prevailing prices for a region. So it doesn't always save us money, and I can talk about how that works later if you're interested. But it definitely lowers wages in the surrounding community when a large Walmart store pops up. So everybody in the community, not every single person, but on average, the wage structure is changed by the presence of a large discounter, particularly in a small community. It is changed, and so people, there's downward pressure on wages and benefits, and so the whole community has to deal with that.
And I guess some of the things that are more expensive are things like electronics and particular brand name goods that I suppose they just can't get the discount for that they force their other suppliers to give?
You mean at a particular Walmart store won't net? I'm sorry, could you please repeat?
Yeah, I think one of the things you wrote is that things like electronics are not necessarily cheaper at Walmart. They might actually be more expensive than a competitor.
Well, one of the points I make is that some electronics, for example, and that's a very good example, thanks, Chris, for bringing it up, are not the same in Walmart that they are in other stores. They're made specifically for Walmart, so it's impossible to make a comparison. It may look the same, but if you check carefully, you'll find that the model number will be different. And then you'll go online and you'll try and find that exact model number to make a good price comparison, and you can't. And also, if you look online, you'll find a lot of chatter about how these goods that are made specifically for Walmart are often made with cost-cutting measures. So they're really not the same thing. And that's one thing I really hope readers come away with if they give cheap a shot, is to really look at what they're buying, you know, because buying a toaster is not some generic item. It is a specific toaster. And, one is different from the other. It's not, I think we all know this, you know, we do know it when we think about it. But often we forget that price is only one factor. And as I say in the book, price is not an objective thing. We think of it as a number and that it's very objective, and it's not. Price is probably one of the most emotional things that exist about a product. It elicits strong emotion in us.
Yeah, you looked into how discount prices or apparent discount prices affect even our brains. Can you talk about what you learned?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I have to say, I mean, it was... because I think I'm probably the most deal-prone person on the planet. I learned a lot about myself doing this book. Low price elicits an emotional response in us. Freud talked about two processes in the brain, the first process and the second process. And basically, that's a fancy way of saying we have an emotional side and we have a rational side. And price, especially low price, elicits this emotional response that tends to dampen our more rational side and makes us respond impulsively.
Ellen Ruppel-Schell is my guest. She's a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. Her new book is called Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. We'll return to the conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us now by getting on the line at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ellen Ruppelschell. She's a correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine. Her newest book is called Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Ellen, we have these emotional responses to cheap prices, even though sometimes we know we're being tricked. And one thing that you look into pretty extensively here is the way goods are priced down to the last digit. We all know the whole 99 cents really equals the next dollar up game, and yet we're still fooled by it.
We are, and not only are we fooled by it, and that includes me, but the psychologists I talk to who specialize in marketing say they, too, are often fooled by it. And by that, I don't mean that we're thinking through and saying, oh, yeah, that's cheaper. The whole point is that we're not thinking it through. And that is, you know, we make these decisions very quickly. We have to make decisions quickly. The brain is wired so that we can make some decisions very quickly. And we associate the 9 at the end of a string of digits with a good deal. Okay, so if you have a $10.99, for example, we think $10. Just instantly. We don't really think it through. Now, some of this, when we apply our thought processes, we go, yes, we know it's $11. But in fact, we're not always applying those processes when we shop. We just don't have time.
And in addition to those deals where the price seems maybe a dollar less than it actually is, there are a lot of products that are sort of never sold at what is claimed to be the full prices. Can you talk about the mattress business?
Sure. Now, Chris, have you ever bought a mattress and paid full price for it?
No, of course. You have to go when there's that special sale and you get the mismatched set and you pay a fraction of the cost.
Absolutely. I mean, very few of us have actually paid full price for a mattress. And very few of us actually know what a mattress should cost. Part of the reason for that is mattresses are sold on sale pretty much universally across the country, and especially in department stores and discount stores. They're put on sale, or what we're told is a sale, and the other mattresses of different brands are not on sale. And the sale price is actually the real price. The other prices for the mattresses that are not on sale is what we call a reference price. It seems like our sale price is lower because the reference price of the other mattresses is higher. But the retailer doesn't really expect to sell many mattresses not on sale. What the retailer does generally is rotate his whole selection of mattresses, or most of them, through this so-called sale price, expects to sell those mattresses at that price, and still pockets a good profit. Now, there's nothing really wrong with that, except for the consumer doesn't really know it. And this is particularly true, this reference price trickery is particularly true for things we don't buy a lot of and we don't know a lot about. So mattresses are a good example. Jewelry is a particularly good example.
So when we walk into a store and it looks like all the gold is marked 60% off, we're not necessarily getting a deal. It's just that everything else has been marked up that much.
Well, yes, and there's a good chance that it was never sold for any significant amount of time at that higher price. Now, in some states, this is not legal, but as many people told me, these laws are not enforced. In some states, you're supposed to have some of these goods on at the full price for a certain number of days before you can put them on sale. But as I say, these are not commonly enforced, and as the discounting craze became stronger and stronger, more and more goods were labeled with their reference price. The reference price would be crossed out, and there would be that lower price. So goods that you would never buy at a given price, you will buy because you see, wow, at one point, this sweater was worth $150, but now I only have to pay $50, so it's a great deal.
So if you walked in and saw it next to a bunch of $50 sweaters, you might pass right by it.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you shop like this, Chris, but I sure did.
Yeah, and the other, I guess, trap for this, one of the experts that you talked to called it the epitome of the reference pricing scam, is the outlet mall industry, which is huge in this country.
Yes, and it's true. Outlet malls are the biggest travel destination in America, not the biggest shopping destination, the biggest travel destination.
So people go there for vacations?
Just about. They certainly do in my area. It's considered to be a recreational activity, but people buy about 80% more in outlet stores. They spend about 80% more in an outlet store than they do in a traditional mall. So when you think about it as a vacation, you better think about it as an expensive vacation.
Well, and I guess it doesn't hurt that very often they are 15 or 20 miles outside of town, so you feel like you've reached this destination and you're not going to turn back without getting a bargain.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you probably won't turn around without getting a few bargains because you've just spent, on average, 25 miles driving in your car, burning up that gas, using that time. And so, and those of you, your listeners who have traffic jams know how much time that can add up to. So you're going to have to pay that investment back by making more purchases than you would at a traditional mall.
And for people who don't know this yet, a lot of the merchandise in outlet malls is, in fact, created specifically at a lower quality for these discounters.
Yeah, I didn't know this, and I bet some of your listeners are wiser shoppers than I was. I actually brought a business scholar with me to an outlet mall outside of Las Vegas, and she showed me how many of the goods were unique to the outlet mall. So when you were comparing them to a price, a so-called price of a brand outside the mall, those things did not exist outside the mall, outside the outlet. These were made specifically for the outlet.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Ellen Ruppel-Schell, whose new book is called Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Let's go to Lauren in Dallas. Hello, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Ellen, I wanted to say the book is fantastic. I'm really enjoying it, and I've already recommended it to a lot of people. I have some friends who are artisanal jewelry makers, and they're so excited about it because it's what they've been saying for years.
Wow, I'm thrilled with that, and I'd love to meet some of your friends.
Yeah. Well, my question is that while I think this is definitely true for products, I haven't seen it so much yet in the service industry, and in particular, I'm thinking about estheticians. For example, on Saturday night, I had an event to go to. I had my makeup done. I paid $50 plus tip, and I never would have thought of saying, can you do me one better? And even if I had shopped around, it wouldn't have mattered. They're all about the same. People are paying $70 for facials and, you know, $50 plus for massages. Why do you think this is in this pamper industry? How come this cost-cutting effect hasn't hit it yet? And do you think it's unique, or do you think in the service industry it will happen, or is it somehow immune to this?
This is such a fantastic question, really, and it's something I have thought a little bit about, probably not enough about. But you're absolutely right. We don't shop around. Many of us don't shop around for what we think of as luxury services. So, you know, whether it's getting our hair done or maybe a personal trainer for some people or, as you said, you know, your makeup done. Once we've entered into the realm of luxury, oftentimes we swing the other way. We overpay. So that has nothing to do with the service industry, okay? That's true in all sorts of so-called luxury goods. For example, I found in luxury handbags are marked up about 13 times in the in certain luxury department stores. So once we swung over to the luxury category, it's almost like caution is thrown to the wind. We no longer concern ourselves with low price. But also, Americans oftentimes don't think of service when they're thinking about products. So when you talk about, for example, the artisanal jewelry industry, which you're a member of, we often don't think of the hard work the jewelers put into actually crafting jewelry. We don't want to pay for that hard work, but we do pay for that work when we actually see the service being provided, such as in the case of the makeup artist you were describing. So it's a little schizophrenic, okay? But again, fairly consistent.
I wonder, too, if there's something psychological about the fact that it's harder to look someone in the eye who you see sort of working on you and touching you and providing this service. It's harder to look that person in the eye and say, I only want to give you $15 for this.
You know what? That is absolutely true. And as the center of these large discounters grows further and further away from us, in other words, it's not a merchant that we know who's providing goods that we know about, his kids go to school with our kids and we grew up with, say a shoe seller, for example, who you see every year and you take your kids back to him and you really don't feel like pushing price quite as hard as you would to someone with someone who is a complete stranger to you and probably doesn't live in your community or even your state.
What impact, Ellen, do low prices have on innovation?
Well, I argue that it has a very powerful one, and I argued this with the help of several economists at Harvard and elsewhere who explained to me that innovation is costly. And whereas Walmart innovated early on with their supply chain, with, you know, their computers and their ability to provide just-in-time delivery and all the things we associate with discounting, right now we're in a cycle where innovation oftentimes is just a matter of cutting staff. It's the quickest way to provide higher efficiencies and drive down the price is to cut staff, to fire employees. It's very easy, very quick. However, that does not allow for true innovation. And those of you, of your listeners who are working in an industry where staff has been cut, radically cut, to lower prices and improve profit margins, know how hard it is to innovate in that climate, to take chances, to try things that may not work out. So I argue that, you know, fundamental bedrock principles of the American economy are endangered by this push to lower prices and cut wages and benefits and cut human capital.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Ellen Ruppel-Schell about her new book, Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Let's go next to Plano and speak with Ken. Hey, Ken.
Hi, I just wanted to ask about perceived value. Why is it it seems that you can never get a good deal at these chains that are going out of business at the big liquidation sale? Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
A good deal, meaning, that's oftentimes these liquidation sales, of course, provide very, very low prices. But then oftentimes you wonder why these chains are going out of business in the first place. So a good case in point would be Circus City, which did go out of business. And part of the reason they went out of business was because they cut all their employees with experience and knowledge. Okay, so these employees were more costly than, say, a high school kid that they could get to work after, you know, school. And what they did was do something which historically worked for other discounters like Frank Woolworth. They tried to undercut the wages of their staff. They cut their staff. And so eventually this caused a cascade of bad news for Circuit City, and they went out of business. So in some cases, various retailers can underprice themselves right down to the graveyard.
One of the phenomena we've seen in recent years that you write about here is the fact that certain items that used to be considered luxuries are now much more affordable to average middle-class Americans. A good example here is shrimp, which used to be a special occasion food and now I think is making it to the everyday tables of a lot more people. How is that possible?
Well, in the book I talk about the shrimp industry, which of course you in Texas are very familiar with. The Gulf of Mexico is an important source of wild shrimp in the United States and the world. But when it was decided that we could produce even cheaper shrimp by going, for example, to Thailand and farming them in shrimp ponds in Thailand, which caused enormous environmental devastation in Thailand because you had to put a lot of inputs, antibiotics, to keep those shrimp alive in these very crowded, muddy, dirty ponds. What was happening with a luxury food, shrimp, which to many of us remember when shrimp was kind of a treat. You know, you'd have a shrimp. I don't know if your viewers or your listeners are old enough to remember shrimp cocktail, but I am, and it was a big treat that my parents used to serve at parties, and maybe we could sneak one or two, but that was it. Now you can go to some so-called casual dining places, and on some nights get all you want shrimp for maybe 15 or 16 bucks. And I even found one case of a waiter saying that one of his patrons ordered 200 shrimp for 15 bucks. Now, this is not a luxury anymore. And the way it's happened, of course, is through a chain of events that I think a lot of consumers are unaware of. If they knew, as I do now, how shrimp is grown in Thailand and the consequences of that for the Thai people, as well as for the shrimp that we're eating, they'd probably think twice before they bought it.
Of course, it can be tough to know where a food comes from.
It can be tough, and I do argue that products should be labeled. so that it's very clear at the point of purchase where they're made. And I would also take it another step and say, look, why not put up on a website who the supplier is for these various things? You know, who's making this? Where's the factory? Any information we can get about the factory would be helpful, too. I don't think of this as some big onus on discounters. I think it's something they could do.
All right, let's talk about furniture, because this used to be something that we would buy maybe once in our lives, and whatever coffee table you had was expected to last for decades. Now we live in the era of IKEA, where every couple of years, you know, suddenly reds and golds are not in style. You're looking at grays and blues, and so you just sort of dump what you had before and redecorate everything.
Right, and some people argue, and I think this is a good point, that we live in a, especially young people, are don't expect to stay in the same place for very long, so they don't need permanent furniture. They don't want their grandmother's furniture. And I'm sympathetic to that. Of course I am. However, I argue that, in fact, in some ways, IKEA furniture is too expensive for what it is, that people may want to reconsider, you know, buying secondhand things or even using, you know, boards and cinder blocks as they're and painting them, doing a nice job with it, as their bookshelf, rather than going to IKEA and buying things that I found are, first of all, not necessarily produced with the most environmental with environmental considerations in mind. But also, I also found many IKEA products are really made to be disposable. They would call them biodegradable, but they're really disposable. Some of their, for example, night tables are made from cardboard and veneer. So I don't think that many of us think of a table as you know, being made of cardboard. We think of it being made of wood or maybe even solid plastic. But these are the designs that are produced by this company because it's very, very cost effective. And I think it's very hard for us to know if a night table made out of cardboard with veneer on the outside is even worth the $49.99 that IKEA charges for it.
Ellen Rubel-Shell is my guest. Her new book is called Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ellen Rubel-Shell, who's a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and has a new book out called Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, and that's where we hear from Fuad, who asks what you think about the concept of sweat-free communities, basically the nationwide campaign requiring city governments to include a sweatshop-free clause in the procurement process for their employees' apparel.
Well, you know, on the most superficial level, I applaud it. I'd have to read it and carefully consider it. But, of course, I do not agree with those who would argue that sweatshops are necessary. And some very thoughtful people make that argument. I do not agree with it. I think that we can do better than that. I think Americans are capable of actually providing the support that would alleviate some of the pressures on workers in the developing world as well as in the United States. Reconsidering value, of course, is the first step that I talk about in the book, but there are other things as well that we could do.
Switching gears here, I'd like to talk for a minute about rebate offers. We plunk down $150 for a cell phone, but in our minds, we think we paid $50 because we're going to get a $100 check back from this rebate. I was astounded at the low redemption rates for these things.
Yeah, actually, if a rebate a percentage gets to about 30%, retailers think it's a failure. they call that, they look for breakage. That is, they call it breakage. That is that you don't redeem the rebate. So most of us don't redeem rebates, and there's really good sound psychological reasons for that. When you buy something, especially when you get a great deal, or you think you're getting a great deal, the excitement is the deal itself. They've even done brain studies to show this. The biggest, the most exciting thing in that transaction is the actual thinking that you've gotten this great deal. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. Then when you go home and you unpackage this thing and you look at it, there's nothing, it's a bummer to have to cut out the little form and fill it out and send it in. And it detracts from the thrill you've gotten from this great price. So we resist doing it. And I don't know if you've ever done this, Chris, but boy, do I procrastinate on sending out rebates. And oftentimes, certainly before I did the book, I never sent them at all. And so, but at the same time, what's really interesting, if you spend $100 for a printer, a computer printer, and it comes with a $50 rebate, even if you don't redeem it, you tend to tell your friends you spent $50 for the printer. You forget, or you push aside the fact that you didn't go for the rebate. And so the whole notion of rebates is really kind of a win-win for retailers, and not always a win-win for us.
I do send in the rebates, but I had never really in the past thought much about how much I'm then on the line for paying for printer cartridges after I have this great deal in my house.
Right, and that's something, that's another little thing that that folks do. It's called shrouding. So sometimes, say you went to all the work to get your rebate on your printer, and it really only cost you $50 after the rebate, and you're very proud of yourself. What you often don't do is add in the additional cost of things like printer cartridges. So obviously it's how you use things, not what they cost you originally. And if you end up spending extra for each of those printer cartridges, you need to figure that in when you're making the purchase. You need to look at the razor blades, not just the razor. And that's the classic case of shrouding. The original case of shrouding was in the Gillette razor. That's how it kind of got its start, the sort of giving away of the razor, so people forgot how much the blade was going to cost them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Sam in Arlington. Hello, Sam.
Hi, I just had a comment to make. I'm a musician, and I don't know if you've ever been to a Guitar Center or any real larger music store, but they do what you were talking about, that price referencing on the mattresses. They do that on almost every product, especially in Guitar Center. Like, if you look at the tags on my guitar, it says I bought it for $800. That was the price I paid. And then it gave what was said to be the MSRP, which is a good $150, $200 more. But as someone who goes to a lot of guitar events, I know that they really don't cost that much.
So nobody ever pays $1,000 for the guitar you got for $800?
No, no one ever does. It's you'll never see it sold for that.
You know, that's a great example, because guitars are things that most of us don't buy too often. So we don't really know what the full price is. This caller does know because he's a professional. And by the way, I have a relative who makes guitars by hand in Austin, Texas. So I'm very familiar with what goes into making a guitar, and certainly a finely crafted guitar. But he's absolutely right in terms of this reference pricing for things we don't buy a lot. And musical instruments are another great example of that.
Well, and the other frustrating thing about a purchase like that for, I would be buying this stuff for my kids to take lessons, and you don't always know if there's a real difference in the quality between one that retails for $99 and one that's $400.
Right, and that speaks to the decline of service. Americans have, when the caller called in about her makeup artist, most of us don't want to pay for service on objects. If we're buying an object, we don't really like to pay for service. Americans have been kind of educated against service. We think of service as a ripoff, and there's good reason for that. There's good reason why the retailers don't necessarily want you to make a knowledgeable decision among the various products, especially discounters. So you won't really know whether or not the $400 flute or whatever it is really worth more or less than the $600 flute, because you don't have a knowledgeable salesperson educating you as to what the differences may be. So then you can go ahead and make that decision yourself, whether you buy the $400 or the $600. That's your personal private choice. But having the information arming yourself with information is just about the toughest thing.
Does it surprise you that in the age of the internet, when we can instantly find out what 50 different retailers charge for a particular product, that we're still being taken in by some of this?
You know, I argue, Chris, in the book that, in fact, in the ancient bazaar, you know, hundreds of years ago, people actually knew more about what they were buying than we do today with the internet. You know, you might have known who made it. You may be a neighbor of the person who made it. And in any case, you know where he lives and you know where his family lives. And if he rips you off too often, he's going to hear back from you. So today, in this giant bazaar, where we don't even know where our stuff is made many times, the internet is a tool, but it's a tool that's actually very difficult to use. We can compare on price if we know that these things are exactly the same, and sometimes they are, but oftentimes they are not, okay? In the case of automobiles, for example, we do know that a certain automobile make and model is the same, and in that case, the internet can be used very, very effectively. But in many consumer goods, when it's very, very difficult to make comparisons, and certainly comparisons on quality are very, very difficult, the internet doesn't necessarily help you. You can't really make head-to-head comparisons. And also, judging quality is so difficult without expert help that, you know, we're expected to become experts on flutes and guitars and pots and pans and all sorts of things that most of us are not trained to do. And that, again, is because retailers have told us that we shouldn't pay for service.
Did you look into whether or not people return goods that they're not satisfied with if they've bought them at a discount price?
You know, I didn't do the math on that one, and I don't know what the return rate is on things. I know that if you're returning things once again to outlet stores, on average, you're driving 50 miles round trip to do it, and that in itself can be very, very discouraging. So we do pay a price, even if we're shipping things at shipping and handling. We pay a price in our time as well as our pocketbooks when we return things. So it's not a great system for us to protect us against bad value.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Stephanie in Dallas. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wonder what your guest thought about over the last, say, 25 years as we've become a more affluent society. Are the markets really creating the demand, or is the consumer creating the demand? And, I mean, are market companies creating demand versus the consumers creating the demand? And as we've gotten used to these products, now that's why we have these discounters, because, you know, it's just so expensive. Does that make sense?
I'm sorry, are you saying as we become more affluent, could you kindly rephrase that?
Okay, as we become a more affluent society, have marketing companies actually created demand for products, or have consumers demanded the products that we now purchase? And once we get to buying these products and more people want them but can't afford them, then the discounters come in to sell them, you know, instead of just the regular department stores. But are the marketing companies creating the demand?
You know, I think it's a mutual thing. They certainly, when we talk about marketing companies, it is kind of a vague term. Advertising, of course, has created insatiable desire. That's not a new thought. That's something that goes way, way back. Economists talked about this in the 1920s. So we are advertised to, as you know, relentlessly, and that does create desire and makes us want the new thing and the best thing, or we think is the best thing, but especially the new thing all the time. So the idea that if something is old, and in the case of a cell phone, it can be less than a year old. Those of you who have teenagers know, I do, that a year-old cell phone is like an antique to a teenager, right? They want new ones every 5 minutes if they can get them. That's an exaggeration, but certainly every 6 months. And we're told that the new is the better. And since we can't afford to buy quality new things all the time, we're getting discounted things, knowing lots of times that they're not high quality, that they won't last very long, and they won't even necessarily function for us properly in the short time we own them, but realizing that we cannot afford to buy something new at a higher price. So what's gotten cut out here is the idea of lasting value, of something being of value to us over a period of time so that it actually pays back its investment, even to the point, in the case of teenagers, that you can put it on Craigslist and resell it. which is something that we used to do all the time. And what's really interesting to me as I've gone around talking to people about this book is some people say, you know, I go to yard sales now, and the stuff is such crap, I don't want to buy it anymore because it was so cheap to begin with. It's not really functioning well. So even buying secondhand has become more difficult for consumers.
Well, and it's really interesting because I think there's also the phenomenon of people not wanting to spend a lot in the first place, knowing that whatever it is they're able to obtain probably won't last.
Right. And, you know, I argue that we have a different relationship with the things we buy than maybe our parents did, or maybe some of us did just 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. You know, many of us spend money at the cash, at the checkout counter for extended warranties. We don't even expect, especially in the case of electronics, we don't expect it to last, and we're willing to pay more to get our to get a replacement because we assume this thing is going to fall apart. And this is not something that our parents and grandparents who might have bought a television and owned it for 20 or 30 years expected of their goods. They expected that when they wanted to get rid of something, they did it because it was their decision, not something that was decided for them based on this very, very low price at the point of purchase.
Well, and those warranties would seem to be a cash cow for retailers as well, because if whatever product, if the DVD player you buy today is expected to be obsolete in 3 years, by the time you need it to be fixed, you decide, oh, I really want this one with these 10 new features.
Absolutely. And, of course, changing superficial features, on, especially in electronics, is a very good trick to getting people to throw out the old and buy the new. No question about that. Whether or not that feature is of benefit to the consumer is something very, very hard to determine for most of us.
So it's obvious listening to you throughout the hour that some of your approach to the things you buy and own have it's changed. But since you mentioned that you're the mother of teenagers, how are you communicating this to them as they're sort of at the dawn of their time as consumers, and you're trying to give them these values before they make the same mistakes that all of us have?
Well, you know, those of your listeners who have teenagers know that preaching to teenagers does not work very well. So I try not to get on my high horse, because that's when the iPod goes on and the child walks out the door. What I try to do is make encourage them to make shopping more fun for them, which means that they're going to bring more knowledge to it and have more control over it. And that means when they go to a store, they're not just directed by the silly price tags that are saying, come on, what a great deal, because they now know that it's really not that great a deal. It might be a low price, but listen, everybody can get that low price. So how can it be such a great deal if it's available to everyone? It oftentimes is not a great deal. So I say, use your imagination. Put your own knowledge to work for you. So, for example, I have two daughters, so clothing is a big factor, right? I say, you know, look, secondhand stores, finding something that's a very, you know, good quality, secondhand, that you can do whatever you want to it. Maybe you take the sewing machine to it or a needle and thread and do your own, you know, design on it. Anything you want, that'll become yours, and that'll be true value for you. And it seems to be working.
Ellen Ruppelschell is a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. Her newest book is called Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Ellen, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, and your listeners were just great. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.